on the notes, if I might, and then I think more of this will come out in terms of opening up the conversation. So, could we look at page number 13 on page 4 in the notes, because I want to complete the material that he's been presenting on the Universal Hebrew Word. In the method of interpretation, the potential totality of meaning, which you are the potential totality of meaning, and the potential totality of modes of expression, which you also are, go into that, but you can pick it up, I think, constitute the upper blade of generalities that are determined in their specificity by the lower blade techniques of scholars. So, in other words, I bring that as an upper blade to the texts and the documents that I'm reading. And this is the contribution that Lonergan wants to make to the theory of interpretation. As I said a moment ago, he's never intending to present a full hermeneutics. So he relies, for instance, in the method of theology a lot on Gadamer's. If you look at the footnotes in the chapters on interpretation, and especially history, as filling out a lot of the material that he's talking about. But experience, understanding, judgment, decision, and then the related sequences of expression, sequences and levels of expression, become an upper blade similar in hermeneutics to the calculus in physics. You've got to have this, right, if you're going to be able to do the correct interpretation of data. So in interpretation, if you are in possession of this structure, and the possibilities, and to the extent that the better you've got it, the better off you're going to be at being able to interpret the data that are in texts, and particularly in philosophic texts, which is the main thing that he's concerned with. Remember, his main concern in this chapter is how do you explain the views of other philosophers. So it's mainly a hermeneutic that he's, or a contribution that he's offering towards the philosophical hermeneutics, hermeneutics of philosophic texts. So as the better off, the more I'm familiar with the calculus and operator equations and so on and so forth, not only differential but operator equations for the statistical part, the better off I will be at understanding the data that are presented for physical examination and so on. So in hermeneutics, the more I'm familiar with the structure of my own consciousness, experiencing, understanding, judging, decision, the sequences and levels of expression that are isomorphic with that. Experience expresses itself one way, understanding, judgment, decision, then the better off I will be at interpreting the data. So that's the upper blade. The upper blade has two components which respectively regard meaning, EUJD, and expression, the sequences and levels of expression. Both components are concretely universal, for they regard the potential totality of meaning and the potential totality of modes of expression. Now, this is what I want to just emphasize here, what's in bold print here. For the totality of meanings, the upper blade is the assertion that, this is now for philosophical text, the protean notion of being, the protean is the ancient figure Proteus who took on all different forms. The consciousness as notion of being is differentiated by a series of genetically and dialectically related unknowns. That's the anticipation. And think there, again, of Crow's thing of at some point the second level became distinct, differentiated from the first. At a later point, the third became differentiated from the second. At a later point, the fourth level became differentiated from the first two, from the first three. So different. There's a genetic and dialectical relationship in this process of differentiating the notion of being, the notion of the good, our reaching out towards God. We come to understand those in a more differentiated fashion as history progresses. And for the totality of modes of expression, the upper blade is the assertion that there's a genetic process in which modes of expression move towards specialization and differentiation on sharply distinguishable levels. You can give expression on this level. Advertisers, as he points out, they don't want you to move to these three lots. Okay? They want to appeal to that level, and they want to do everything they can to keep you from raising critical questions. And their expression then is their expression is going to be focused in on this to get you to want whatever it is that they're trying to sell you. They don't want to raise the questions for understanding the judgment and decision. So if a correct interpretation is possible, if it's possible, it has to be possible for the interpreters to proceed from their own experience, understanding, and judgment to the range of possible meanings of documents, and for them to determine which of the possible meanings are to be assigned to each of the documents. Unless they can envisage the range of possible meanings, they will exclude a priori some meanings that are possible, and such exclusion runs counter to the possibility of correct interpretation. Unless they can connect possible meanings with actual documents, interpretation again becomes impossible. But the possibility of envisaging the full range of possible meaning lies in this universal viewpoint, and the possibility of connecting possible meanings with particular documents lies in the genetic sequence that extrapolates from past to present correlations between meaning and modes of expression. All right, now, I don't know how much more of this we want to go into, because I think there are questions that were raised here about the adequacy of this approach and so on. Sean, do you want to raise some of those issues and maybe we can tease them out in the conversation? Right? You were on to some questions that I thought perhaps might get the discussion out better.
I don't know where to begin. There's so many things going on.
I don't mean to be putting you on the spot, but you had a number of questions. Right.
Can I start with a question before, maybe?
Pardon me?
Can I start with a question before? Maybe you can formulate.
Sure.
This process, it doesn't seem like it goes backwards in time, because as time moves forward, our language for discussing just about anything becomes more technical and more divided. So if we're trying to go backwards in time with this, if there was no differentiation, I can't think of a good example, but an example, I guess, from New Testament studies, we go back and we say that the Israelites at the time of Jesus didn't really separate person from essence, so that when we try and look back, when we try and read what they say, we've already got very elaborate theories of what all of those terms mean, which they didn't have. So for us to do an interpretation of that, first of all, we could never know, because they have a very fuzzy term, and we don't know what in that fuzzy term corresponds to our much more precise terms. So it doesn't seem like this really, to me, it doesn't seem like this is helps that much when you're trying to go backwards, especially if you're trying to go backwards past an epoch where language has changed, you know, where language has become more technical than language that you're using now.
I would make two comments on that. First of all, the contributions of this chapter are specifically directed to the reading of philosophic texts.
Take Plato.
Yeah. Okay. And that's so. I think let's take Plato, because I do think that. If you read Plato from an appropriation of this structure, you've got a better chance of understanding what his insights were. I think you do.
To some extent, I think you do, but you're still going. I mean, Plato's. I have to get a particular example from Plato. I just think that Plato's philosophic terminology is so looser or fuzzier than ours is, that for us to project our stuff back into that, I think it's almost impossible for us to take our concepts, which are much more precise than Plato's were, and try and get at what he was really thinking, because it's just like there would be so much. It's like I can't give a concrete example, but let's say that there was a concept that Plato had that we now use five different concepts to, that really covers the same thing that Plato was getting at in his one concept, right? How could we ever know which of the five terms that we currently have is closest to what Plato meant when Plato didn't have any way of distinguishing? He didn't have the same differentiation of consciousness that we have. If he didn't have the same differentiation of consciousness that we have now, how can we know other than to say, well, he didn't mean any of the things that we mean because he didn't have that differentiation of consciousness?
But we can know what differentiation he did have. And that's the point. That's precisely the point that he's making here. That a determinate differentiation of the notion of being in the next number, 14. That's what you can know. And that's what you can know that Plato reached. That's what Crow is saying, for instance, that in Plato there is a determinate differentiation of the second level of that notion of being from the first that is not as clear prior
exactly.
to Plato in the history of Western philosophy.
That's right.
So that Plato did achieve that differentiation. And the more I know this structure, the better I can appreciate that achievement in Plato. That's the point.
Sure, that's true, and I think that's a very valid point. But then to really know when I'm reading him, so I guess I can sort of put him in a box. I can put his ideas in a box, but I can't really know. I don't know. I need to get a concrete example.
No, I think, I also think that this has to be complemented with the materials that Lonergan presents on interpretation and method and theology, where the issue is fourfold. Because I think you're getting at some of the first three of those four, and in what he's suggesting in insight here is really the fourth of the components that he's suggesting in, that he gives in method and theology. There's understanding. The thing, loosely used, that the author is talking about. So I must already have some kind, if I'm picking up a text of Plato, I've already got to have some kind of understanding of the issues that Plato is dealing with. And the more I have, the better understanding I have of those issues, the better understanding, the better chance I have of understanding what he was saying. To understand the thing, sometimes I've got to... I might find that what I've got here is not sufficient yet to understand Plato. I've got to understand the words. And so I've got to do a lot of work in Greek, in the history of the Greek language, in order to understand the words that he used. And I may find that I've got to do some research into what's available on his life and times, understanding the author. But then I'll find, and the more we're talking about the classic works in philosophy and religion, the more we will discover that that's not enough. And this is the point that Lonergan's making exclusively in insight. But in method, in addition to these first three, there are some times where I will not understand text of another author without undergoing a change in my understanding of myself. Or there has to be a development in myself before I can understand what somebody else is talking about. So understanding oneself as condition for understanding someone else. So perhaps when I brought this in today, I should have taken this framework and integrated this, because this is all that he's talking about in insight. But to the extent you understand yourself, to that extent you've got a better chance of understanding someone else. But in method, that's one of four preliminaries that you have to bring. And I think what you're talking about is a lot about the words and the author himself, and the more we understand the language that he used, and the more we understand the details even of his own life and how they give rise to certain questions, the better chance we have of understanding where he's coming from. But the very fact that he's a classic author whose work will never die, those are precisely the authors that we are better equipped to understand, the better we understand ourselves. And so it's from understanding yourself that you can appreciate that there's a determinate differentiation of the notion of being that is present in the works of Plato. You can really value that if you and that's the point that insight is emphasizing.
So, okay, and I guess my problem, it goes to this idea about the idea about the what the term is, but the idea of all of the possible things that I could interpret. Like, I can ask questions of Plato that I can't find answers to in Plato, because my differentiation of consciousness is different than Plato's differentiation of consciousness. And even if I were able to talk to Plato, he might have been able to answer them, but I'll never find them.
No, that's true. That's definitely true. But on the other hand, you see, we wouldn't be where we are today if he hadn't done what he did.
No, yeah, absolutely.
That's the part of it that he's trying to help us get to.
Yes.
That if we understand EUJD, then we can understand that E and U got really differentiated in this guy. That was a big step for him. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't have EUJD differentiated if this hadn't taken place. Sure.
But just to kind of pick up on that, a few of the questions we had over on this side. The question of philosophic text is one that maybe we'll start with. But, you know, Plato is philosophic text, but Plato also, these dialogues are also very literary.
That's right.
Kierkegaard is as literary as he is philosophical. Nietzsche, in many ways, is as literary as he is philosophical. What I find that term philosophic text, because there are lots of things that started out as novels and strictly literary works are very philosophical. So if this doesn't, this reading is reading, and again, some of the postmoderns will say, look, it's all poetics, it's all texts, all sort of a poetic language. No differentiation between history, philosophy, theology, science. That's one question.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What you have here, I like this. I very much agree with, and this is sort of another point we were bringing up. I made the point during the break that this idea of a dialogue between yourself and the text. There are other voices in there. Your voice, Father Crow's voice, are part of this dialogue. The example of Plato.
I mean, part of
my
of
experience,
that
my dialogue with this includes other voices.
I'll come back to that.
And then, I think sort of what we're getting at, think of the example of Plato's dialogues here, and think of, there are those great little Loeb classics, you know, which look great on your bookshelf. But if you don't read the Greek, and you just read the English, that tells you really very little about Plato.
That's true.
Tells you a lot about Victorian England.
That's true.
And you never really get back to Plato.
That's true.
So those are just some of the.
But that's the understanding the words, you know. You've got to.
The author then is the Victorian translator. It's not Plato.
No. But understanding the words means understanding the Greek.
So if we don't have the Greek. If we don't have Plato's manuscripts, we have somebody else's claim that these are Plato's manuscripts.
Well,
like our scriptures.
Like our scriptures, yeah. We don't have anything that Socrates wrote. We only have a Plato.
Socrates didn't write it.
Okay, so we have.
So we only, certainly our only access to Socrates is through the Platonic dialogues.
Okay. So these are some of the questions.
And the access to Jesus is
right.
Through what other people wrote about him, because he didn't write it.
And ultimately, I think it is about
not
only access. Yeah. And this is one thing that I think this is very complementary to what's being said now in the Lost. It is about understanding ourselves. The questions we ask about Plato have far less to do with what Plato says as they tell us about what we think. Why are we asking those questions? What are our priorities and concerns and worries? Why do we bring these things to certain texts? Why do some texts go in and out of favor in different periods? That tells us a lot more about ourselves and our world and our concerns. And that's really maybe where the emphasis should be. And that's always my thought of reading literatures, and what does it tell you about you? Why are you drawn to this character, this plot development, this particular type of literature?
Okay, but I don't want to, I mean, I don't think this reading is exclusively in that direction, and I don't want to go exclusively in that direction. He wants, Lonergan wants you to appreciate that there is a differentiation of consciousness that is very clearly present, for instance, in the Platonic dialogues, you know, and that that's a major step in the unfolding of human cultural evolution. Something very important happened at that point. And he wants you to appreciate that, and to appreciate that this is the, you mean what he refers to in his own one place in the Latin writing as the Miraculum Graeco, you know, that this got done, that it's almost a miracle that we were able to sort this out, you know, got started. But nothing would have happened without that in terms of what's happened in the development of science and philosophy. So it's a big, and that's appreciated what's in those texts, no matter how those texts came to be assembled. The fact is that differentiation is there. On the business of philosophy and literature, I am with Lonergan and Habermas on this, that you cannot reduce philosophical texts to simply literary texts. I don't think they are. I think that it's a genre of writing that has a certain technical emphasis to it that is not present in poetry and fiction and so on. And Habermas is very strong on this too, in versus Derrida, and the non-reduction of philosophic writing to literary writing. That there is a technical intention that has to be respected and honored in philosophical texts.
Yeah, I mean,
And even in
I'm
Plato,
I'm hurt by the hierarchy of that. But well, how do you elevate? What does it take then to elevate a literary text?
We can get rid of the hierarchical. You cannot identify. Okay, you have to put it in a hierarchical fashion. There is an intention, and even in Plato and Kierkegaard, there's an intention that is conveyed literarily, but that is not fiction, and that is not poetry. That is attempting to state a truth about being, okay, in a way that is not simply it's not simply literary expression. Kierkegaard's distinctions of aesthetic, ethical, and religious living are conveyed through Don Juan and the doctor who's making the decision and the Abraham and Isaac story, but there's a point that he's making in this truth claim. All right, so hierarchical, you can't equate them, you know.
So is that literature, is that philosophy then?
Kierkegaard would be philosophy theology, I think, expressed in literary language. But his intention is to express the truth about being in a way that who's picked up on Kierkegaard? You know, what tradition is picked up on? It's a philosophical, theological tradition.
Because I just think about the classics in literature.
And who gave him his problems? Hegel.
Yeah, but like if you look at the classics in literature, there are
philosophic influences.
Yeah, not just philosophical influences, but like you can even see like real philosophical intent, you know, making some kind of claim about ultimacy and meaning, you know, meaningfulness in life, possibility of it, that kind of things. But what I'm interested in, you mentioned before you left this notion that we can get back to the authorial intent of the text.
Is it time? My watch is going slower now.
Robbie's leaving early.
Is it 4 o'clock? I've had problems with that. I didn't watch. So, if you need to leave, I always do so. What? The author's intention.
The author's intention. So, is Lonergan saying that? Because when I first started reading this chapter, I thought that that's kind of what he was getting at, but then when I got through it, I thought, oh no, he's not saying that at all. I mean, when you say understand the author, we read the Greek manuscripts of Plato in Greek. Do we understand, when you say understand the authorial intent, what do you mean by that?
I think that there's a way in which you can disengage what the final product is intending to communicate. I think you can.
In like one interpretation?
Not one exhaustive interpretation.
Okay. Because, that's one key point for Gadamer, for these people, that you can't get to the authorial intent, which doesn't mean that relativist conclusion of interpretation is. Text makes a unique claim upon an interpreter, but at the same time, the text takes on such a life of its own because it's involved with and contributes to these matrices of meaning that are culturally and historically.
Without denying any of that, I don't see why that rules out penetrating to the intention that is coming to expression in the text.
So to the extent that the author, because he was writing a long time ago, didn't lack the tools, the language to get at what he was trying to communicate, I would agree that was true. But going back, like if Plato uses a concept that we now treat as five different related concepts, but at the time it was not possible for them to distinguish between those five in any kind of systematic speech, then you'll never know which of those five things he was really after. So when we look at it from our perspective, we can...
But you can hypothesize about it.
We can.
And some hypotheses are going to be better than others, and there'll be more evidence for some than there will be for others. See, I don't see where... I don't see where the emphasis of Gadamer and Ricoeur, both of which the emphases are fine, why they rule out the other one. That's the only question that I'm asking. Ricoeur's great on the world in front of the text.
Yes.
But why not something about the world out of which the text arises? I don't see why he says you can't get to that at all.
Well, I guess my question that I would put back to you then, coming from that perspective, is what do you see as that move behind the text that... is because I see that move behind the text is very different from what you've just said in terms of some interpretations are going to be better than others. That means that your interpretations have the status of a hypothesis. You know, Lonergan says that the understanding of the text goes through you and your own insights. So that means your common sense pattern, your patterns of experience. So in that sense, it's like that's what I see Ricoeur and Gadamer saying, but because it goes through you, it's not. There is no world behind the text.
But there is somebody that put that text together. Some one individual who wrote it, or a community that assembled it, and they had an intention of doing
right,
that. And I can know what that is. I can make judgments about that intention.
But the only way you know about Plato's Greece is by reading other texts that were written by other authors that made other judgments.
That doesn't rule out that some of that is accurate. Okay.
Which
song? Huh?
Which song?
It's the ones that for which there's evidence, you know?
Well, I'm not saying that there isn't a possibility for accurate interpretations, but what I'm saying is that if you say that there is accurate interpretations and that you are involved, that the insights have to come through you in order to be apprehended, that there is no world behind the text because that's not the way it works. If it comes through
you... world behind is maybe... I mean, maybe that's prejudicing the issue. There is an intention that is expressed in the text, okay?
There is an intention...
And I can make a judgment about that, and it may very well be that judgment approximates a true understanding of what the other person is trying to say.
Yes, and that's why you need a community of interpreters, because a text has an excess of meaning, and other people are going to come to different... interpretations. Is there the possibility? Yes, but it's again going to need conversation and dialogue and all
okay,
that
but
kind of stuff.
These examples that I'm trying to give here, like Plato actually grasped that there was a difference between understanding and experience. He did.
Mm.
He grasped that and he expressed that. That is a true judgment. I'm sorry, but it's a true judgment. He did grasp that difference. And I'm saying that I'm understanding that, and that's an accurate understanding of what is coming to expression in his writing.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm not
making
trying,
that claim.
Yeah, I know you are. You're going to sign it.
And that's valid.
Right. So that is an example of something that you can, that an intentionality you can discover.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a concrete example of an intentionality that you can discover that has been.
In some senses, I understand what you're talking about, but for me, the guarantee that I can understand the intent of the author is that he was also, or she was also, a human being. And as a human being, as a thinker, as a subject, he or she had also thoughts and feelings and everything else. Now, probably it wasn't that differentiated or whatever, but context was different. But the subject was there. The intersubjective aspect is there too. It crosses all through history.
But
if it would have been an alien from somewhere, then probably.
All of this stuff in method, by the way, it is getting at the fundamental presupposition. It's getting at the point that this is the way to get to what is the intended meaning of the text.
But it's
through these steps.
But I think the point is
so long. It's the same thing that's emphasized by these people in scripture.
So long.
Excuse me, just a second. Ben Meyer, if you want a quick thing, you can read in the book on Lonergan's hermeneutics that Meyer and McKevin edited, read Meyer's essay. Because he's the one who states it as clearly as possible. Mm-hmm. The intended meaning of the text is accessible to the reader.
Yeah, I guess that, like, would you say that's accessible to the degree of high probability?
It depends on the issue, the text, the complexity of it.
So you would say that, like, you're understanding that Plato understood and intended to express the difference between experience and understanding.
You know?
So that's what I'm asking you. Is that, is your affirmed judgment there, like, not just highly probable, that's, like, absolutely beyond all doubt, correct?
I'm saying that he's got that. You know?
Yeah.
He's got that. He's grasped it. And he built his philosophy there.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's enough. An example of that is enough to prove Lonergan's point. It doesn't mean that all the intentions of every philosopher will ever be discovered. It's simply to say that it is possible. So if you can find an example where everybody agrees that this is what happened,
sure,
then yes, you can no longer deny that it's impossible.
Yes. Yeah, coming from these Gadamerian, Ricurian perspectives, they're not going to rule out correct interpretation. So, you know, the possibility of correct interpretation, you say this is correct, I mean, that's completely within the hermeneutical tradition. It's just a question of how accessible, in what way is that accessibility of that correct interpretation? I mean, it's definitely how isn't the question, because it is accessible, but in what way is it accessible? And so, like, that's what I'm wondering about the differences, because you seem to see that here's a sharp distinction between Lonergan and these people like Ricurio Gadamer about this notion of getting behind the text.
Well, I'm not sure yet that it is, how sharp the distinction is, because, I mean, I may be misinterpreting what they mean by world behind the text, but, you know, they seem to be ruling out the possibility of any authorial intention as ever being known by the rest of us. I don't think that's...
Well, yeah, in so much as that's a correct interpretation, then I don't see how they're going to rule that out.
I think the point is that there are more interpretations. For people like Gadamer and Ricoeur, I think they're very close to Lonergan, is that they, I think, take to the point there are more interpretations than the authorial one, and you can come close to approximating what the authorial one is, but you can never be sure. But I always imagine it as sort of where you think you can stop on a slippery slope. And the bottom of the slippery slope is deconstruction and relativism. And you can never know, and all reading is misreading. And then it's trying to stop on the slippery slope. And I think Gadamer and Ricoeur and Lonergan are all stopped at pretty much the same spot. I'm just trying to figure out how firm their grasp, their grip is. Because I want to believe with them, I want to agree with them. And I do agree with them for the most part. But it's still problematic.
What I would want to do is create and putting together hermeneutics is to take these emphases along with the Gadamer and the Gross emphases. And I think you have a pretty good hermeneutics here. I think they offer things that he hasn't done. But I think he's got some things that
they don't
that they're not as good. There's a lot of Hogwarts discussion too.
I don't know any of the Hogwarts.
Yeah, I definitely think that that's the key. Yeah.
But see, I see him as being possible.
Oh, I do too. Definitely.
Okay, thank you. So, chapter 18. Next week.